Welcome to Beat Infertility, a podcast where we get real about infertility, empower you to take back control, and provide you with hope for the future. Ready? Here's your host, fellow infertility warrior, Heather Hooman.
Welcome to episode 222. Today you'll hear the success story of a woman named Dani. She's a 32-year-old sales professional who enjoys reading, traveling, and spending time in the water. Both Dani and her husband were told early in life that they couldn't have children. She had endometriosis, and he had azoospermia because of childhood cancer treatments. Before they got married, she insisted they both have a thorough fertility workup because struggling to build their family was going to be something they'd need to handle tackling as a couple. Shortly after their wedding, they returned to the fertility clinic and chose a sperm donor. Unfortunately, the clinic wouldn't work with that particular sperm bank. It's now several years after their initial fertility workup, and her AMH is low enough that her doctor recommends donor eggs. However, a consultation with our very own Dr. Allison Rogers empowers her to push for using her own eggs. Let's listen to how Dani went on to produce 11 blasts from a single retrieval and get pregnant with her daughter after their third frozen transfer. Hi, Dani. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Heather. It's crazy being here with you. I've listened to so many episodes.
Well, I'm glad to have you here. I want to start by telling folks a little bit about you. How old are you? What do you do for a living? And what do you do for fun?
I'm 32, in sales, kind of a interior design and sales job. So a lot of my time is spent designing. I really enjoy that. That's relaxing. But when not doing that, I really love to read and I love to travel.
Think about your life before infertility. Back then, how would you describe yourself as a person?
It's hard to remember a time before infertility because I found out really early that it was probably going to be a struggle. But before, like, actively dealing with it, I would say I was more relaxed and more spontaneous for sure.
Tell me about the first time you met your husband.
My husband and I met at work, and the first time that we met, we actually, right off the bat, argued about whether something was done right or not. I thought he was new, but he was just new to our location. He had been around for more years than I had. So we started off arguing, and it took us a couple of months to stop arguing about who was doing things right and who wasn't. Eventually, once we got over that, we realized that we had a really similar sense of humor, that we enjoyed the same things, and tried to avoid it for a while because we weren't dating coworkers. Eventually, we went on a group date to the movies, and that one date turned into talking about getting married probably within a couple of months. It was crazy.
Today, how would you describe you and your husband as a couple?
We're super close. We really enjoy spending time together. Like I said, we worked together at first, and most people would go a little crazy working with their significant other and then going home with them and being with them 24/7, but we really enjoyed it. We don't work together anymore. So now anytime that we can spend some time together, that's how we're happiest. And I would say we're just really on the same page as a couple. We have the same goals. We have the same drive, and we really make it a priority to spend time together.
I know you didn't always know that you wanted to be a mom. So was there a specific moment when that changed?
I've always wanted to be a mom. I wasn't sure that I needed to be a biological mom. And for me, when that became something that I was sure that I wanted to pursue, I had a niece who was born when I was 19, and I was in the room for her birth. And it was such an amazing experience. I knew then that I really wanted to get to experience that.
How did longing to be a mom impact other decisions in your life?
So longing to be a mom definitely decided a lot of job questions for me. I had a job in TV production that was basically a dream job, and it was really, really amazing. I was working for four different TV shows on the Discovery Network, and I really enjoyed it. But pay-wise, it wasn't as much as the sales job that I had previously done. And after a year in that position, I went back because we were trying to save for IVF. And after later on, I definitely stayed at that job for years longer than I would have so that we could pursue IVF. Eventually, we even got insurance through that job that covered infertility. So it meant not leaving when I would have. And it was a really easy decision, but in the day-to-day, it was really difficult to be at a job every day that you no longer felt passion for just because you had bigger goals.
Let's dive into the journey to build your family. Take us through your whole infertility timeline, starting with when you were told as a teenager that you would never have children.
My very first OB visit ever, I went because I had had a period that was about 5 weeks long, and it was very, very painful. I had very painful periods all the time. I was 14, and I didn't know it then, but I had like a lot of cysts. My mom took me to her OB, who was a older gentleman, probably in his 60s. And I remember that I cried when he wanted to do the physical exam. And he told my mom that I probably had the same endometriosis that she did, but worse, and that my hormones were crazy, or I wouldn't have had such a long period, and that I probably wouldn't be able to have kids. And he just kind of dropped all of this without doing a single test. And he was very grumpy about it. He was very mad that I had been upset about needing a physical exam, even though I was so young and I had never had one before. So I just remember that I went home and I got on my computer, and it was back in the day on AOL dial-up, and look up, what do you do when you can't have kids? And I learned about IVF, and I think at the time it was called not just IUI, but ICI maybe. And I was like, well, I don't care what he says. I'll do this, and I'll have kids. At the time, the IVF was a whole different thing, and they would put in all the embryos that they got because freezing wasn't an exact process. And I remember finding it terrifying how many times it resulted in multiples. And growing up, I would keep researching what was coming up in the field. I remember being 18 and talking with my best friend about how I wasn't sure if I would be able to have kids, but if not, I would adopt them. Like, it was always on my mind. And when my husband and I got together and started dating really early on, he told me that he couldn't have kids either, or he was pretty sure that he couldn't. He had childhood cancer, and he survived it after multiple rounds of chemo and radiation. But he was told it was unlikely that he would be able to produce sperm. And he had never had it tested because he was so young when he went through it. Like I said, that was the beginning of our relationship. About 4 years later, when we were serious, we were engaged and kind of starting to plan what was next for us, I insisted on doing some fertility testing for both of us because I really thought it was important for us to be on the same page, to know exactly what we were looking at and how we would want to pursue starting a family, whether it was something that we could even pursue, whether we would be going just through trying to figure out a route to adoption, which is also not easy and not cheap in the US, just like IVF back then. And when you haven't really gone through it, it's easy to think that you can make a plan and stick with it. And I wanted us to have a plan. We both did testing, and it was confirmed that my husband had acidospermia, and there was zero sperm production, so that wasn't going to be an option for us. The RE that I saw at the time, I went with just the closest one locally to us. That was how I chose an RE, not the best way, honestly. But at a very first appointment, he listened to my medical history and said it sounded like I had endometriosis, possible PCOS due to the many cysts that I've had that have ruptured over the years, causing pain and sending me to the ER, that he thought I would need a laparoscopy and IVF with donor sperm. And that was just kind of a really big thing to hear at our very first appointment, because this was, again, before doing any testing. He was just going off of medical histories for both of us. We went home and talked about it and kind of reflected on how we felt about it for a while, and decided that we would pursue donor conception when the time came, but that there were some things we wanted to do first. We went ahead, we got married, we purchased their first home because that was really important to my husband. And then once those were done, we were ready to start actively pursuing our infertility treatment. We went back to the same RE, and we actually went once right after we got married to get some pricing so that we could figure out exactly how much we needed to have saved so that we could pursue a full course of treatment. And then so we went back for the third time once we were ready to actively start trying, and saw the same RE, and it was a really unpleasant experience from the beginning. He was like, "Oh, are you finally going to stop wasting my time? Are you going to do something?" It was kind of a off-putting way to start the appointment, but we did it and we did our testing. We talked to them about how we were going to pursue donor sperm and the sperm bank that we wanted to use, which we had already picked out. And the RE said that they only went off of their list of recommended sperm banks. And I reminded him that he had actually told me which ones I could use before, and I had picked one that had prior been on their list the last time I was in there. He said that wasn't an option anymore, that we'd have to talk to their donor coordinator. I told him that it was a really important decision for us, so that if we couldn't use that bank, we wouldn't be pursuing treatment with them. And he got really angry and walked us out to the hallway to the donor coordinator and yelled at her if we could use that bank. And she said we could, and that if we wanted to go ahead and purchase her sample, we just had to get some paperwork from her. The doctor then turned to me and said, "I don't know why you want to go ahead and purchase sperm when we haven't even done any testing. Your tubes might not even work." And this was all middle of the hallway in the fertility clinic. No regards for patient privacy or feelings or anything. We went ahead and took the paperwork, requested a new doctor to meet with the next time. But we stayed with that clinic. And at that time, we purely stayed with that clinic because they had the soonest opening to pursue treatment. And after you had been thinking about it and hoping to do it for years, it's hard to call a doctor and hear our first appointment isn't for another 3 months or another 4 months. I came to regret the decision to just go with the first available. But we did. We came back and we saw another doctor there. And she let us know that from my antral follicle count and my AMH was really low. It was 0.09. At the time, I was 29, so they expected a higher number. There were zero intral follicles visible on ultrasound anytime they checked. She said maybe I was having a bad month and had me come back in again for my next day 3 ultrasound. And again, there were zero intral follicles visible. They could see about 12 cysts there that were all basically too big to count as an intral follicle. They were closer to twice the size, to 3 times the size of what you would expect to see. And so they thought those wouldn't be viable. This new RE told me she wasn't sure that pursuing IVF with my own eggs was going to be possible, and that her recommendation would be, again, to take another month and do a third antral follicle count and see if there was anything that looked viable there. So we did that. We came back for a third AFC count. And again, that was a zero. And again, there was about 12 to 13 cysts just sitting on my ovaries, kind of large and taking up all the space. At that point, we spoke with the doctor again. We were really conscious about how much money we had to use to pursue a cycle at that time. So she recommended that we go the donor egg route. Since we were already using donor sperm, that seemed like a lot. We had already put so much thought into how we wanted to pursue this journey and what was important to us in a donor, that to start that process over again seemed really exhausting. I had been listening to the podcast for months at that time, and I had been listening to Dr. Rogers' bonus episodes. I decided to call and do a phone consult with Dr. Rogers for a second opinion, because the doctors in my area at the time when I called them, I remember it was March, when I called them to see about getting a second opinion, the first available appointment was July, and I didn't want to wait that long. I was able to get a phone consult with Dr. Rogers in a couple of weeks, and I sent her all of my medical records. And when we went over everything together, she told me that because the cysts on my ovaries were simple cysts, she thought it was absolutely worth pursuing around with my own eggs, that we hadn't even seen how my body would respond to the IVF drugs. There was no reason to think that we would get no response at all. So it was worth trying. She would recommend doing no birth control and doing estrogen priming before a cycle. And I went back to the local RE with that. And she agreed to let me do no birth control, although it was a fight. At that RE, they have a way that they do things. They have standard protocols, and they definitely don't like to deviate from them. So she said that I was doing the no birth control against her advice. She wouldn't do the estrogen priming because she said due to the cyst on my ovaries, the only way to know when to trigger me would be depending on the size, depending on my estrogen level. And so we went ahead and tried a cycle with our own eggs. We were told not to expect more than 4 or 5 eggs if we got anything. So we made a decision not to PGS test and to give anything we got a chance. We did the cycle and she tracked my estrogen to figure out when to do the trigger. I remember my estrogen got up into the 6,700s and I thought that was crazy high. But we finally triggered and they were able to get 14 eggs, 13 fertilized, and we actually had 11 make it to blastocyst, which was crazy and unexpected. The doctor was shocked. We were shocked. And from then on, we moved forward. We did a hysteroscopy to remove some polyps. We went ahead and tried a double embryo transfer for the first time. I remember we were so hopeful and so excited because even though we hadn't been preventing a pregnancy for years, we also had never really had a chance at it until then. So we were so, so excited, but that didn't work out. We went back, and when we went back, I had polyps again, so we did another hysteroscopy and another double embryo transfer. And what sticks out the most about that transfer is that the first time we had done progesterone and oil injections, and the second time the doctor told me she was adding in crinone for the cycle to try to get kind of a different reaction. It was 4 or 5 days before my cycle started, and I was talking to the nurses on the phone. And I realized they had never ordered the progesterone and oil for the cycle. They hadn't put it in the chart, even though the doctor had told me that she wanted both. So there was a little bit of panic. Luckily, I still had some from my prior cycle, and I was able to get all the meds that I needed. So we went ahead and did a second transfer. Again, it was a double transfer, and that was purely a financial decision, which looking back seems crazy now, but at the time it seemed really important. And again, that didn't work out. After going through those two transfers, we had gone from having 11 embryos to having 7 left. They weren't PGS tested. And I was kind of worried that maybe my estrogen levels had been too high. And that's why none of the embryos maybe were sticking. So we were really considering doing a new round of IVF, even though we still had 7 blasts left. We went and got a second opinion from a different RE in the area, and he really recommended PGS testing and encouraged us to try again. He said we had a great result the first time. We were able to get a lot more blasts than expected, and pretty much all of the mature eggs made it to blast, which was unusual. So we should be able to use my eggs. And we decided to pursue that second round of IVF from the beginning. At this point, though, we had gotten some fertility coverage from the insurance at work. And when I talked to the insurance company, because I wasn't sure they would cover it while we still had some blasts, they said that they would cover it. But if we actually had a third failed transfer, they would also cover PGS testing. So we decided to go ahead and try one more round of frozen transfers. And when we did that a couple of months down the line, we did another double embryo transfer, and this time we were pregnant at the end, and it was crazy. We didn't expect it. I don't think our clinic expected it either, but it worked out.
Okay, so lots to unpack here. I want to start off pretty early in your journey. You mentioned that you picked the fertility clinic closest to your house. I'm guilty of that as well.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to hear a little bit more about, at that initial appointment, what your impression was of the clinic, the doctor, the rest of the staff. And I believe you changed doctors after that. So sort of tell me at what point your impression changed.
So when we started with the clinic, I remember being impressed because it was a busy clinic. They had four different doctors. The waiting room was always packed. It seemed like they knew what they were doing. And I don't know, at that point in my journey, I was 100% relying on the doctors and kind of Dr. Google. I didn't have any great resources that I was reading. I had no idea what to look for in a clinic. So just the fact that they were busy was kind of by what I went with. I'm like, oh, hey, a lot of people go there, so they have to know what they're doing. And the doctor wasn't the warm and fuzzies kind, but he seemed really competent. He seemed decisive. That was kind of enough because I didn't walk in there with any kind of way to measure what I was looking for or with questions to ask them or anything. I believe I was 25 when I first went there. And I remember he asked me how long we had been trying. And I told him that we hadn't used birth control for about 6 months. And he was like, oh, you can just go and come back in a year. And I was like, well, we also don't have any sperm. And then he was like, oh, okay, so you might need us. But I should have known that the doctor was kind of dismissive from the start. When, like I said, what made us decide to switch doctors was the fact that we had that episode in the middle of the clinic hallway where he told us that maybe we didn't even need sperm because I didn't know if my tubes worked. And it was a really, really uncomfortable, and there was kind of no coming back from that. And instead of switching clinics at that time, I just requested a different doctor. And the one that we got after that, she was a lot nicer. She was more of a, she was more personable. So I felt comfortable moving forward with her. Although there were some clear red flags that looking back at now, it's hard to believe that we stuck with. But she said things like, this is how we run our cycles. No, this is the only way that we do it. It was really obvious that they have a protocol and they follow their protocol. They don't necessarily vary it up according to the patient. And then that was further reinforced later on when I was talking to their nurses that actually run the cycles, because one of the first times I got on the phone with one of their art nurses, she was like, oh yeah, we actually have to send your results into the doctor every day. She's making the medication changes herself. And I was like, wait, what do you mean she's making the medication changes herself? Who makes them for all the other patients that are going through a cycle, you know, between day one and trigger day? You would think your doctor's making decisions, but apparently a lot of times there, they leave it entirely up to the nurses how to change up the medication dosages.
Unlike a lot of people, you knew even before you were married to your husband that you guys would need a donor to conceive. So what were your initial thoughts on donor conception?
When we first considered needing a donor, we kind of went about it the same way that everybody does. You know, you think, oh yeah, there's sperm banks out there. We'll just pick somebody that looks similar to my husband and then that'll be it. We thought we would want an anonymous donor, somebody who would have zero interaction with any child that might result from a pregnancy, or that we wouldn't want that child to even know that they were donor conceived, which is kind of a very old school way of thinking about it and an uninformed way of thinking about it, honestly. Once it became clear that was definitely the way that we were going and that there was no surgery or anything we could pursue, we started reading up on it and learned that donor-conceived people, those who are healthiest and happiest as adults are those that are told early on that they're donor-conceived, and those that have access to information about their donors, sometimes even their identity, depending on what kind of sperm bank or donor relationship you pursue. And it became really important to us to use a donor that was open ID so that later on, if our child wanted to find out more about their biological background, they could. When we began pursuing donor conception, we were thinking about what would be easiest for us as parents to deal with. And the more research that we did, we realized that it was most important to focus on what would be easiest for a child to grow up with. And that turned out, in to us, our decision was to pursue a donor that had the open ID for later on. We still went through a sperm bank because to us that felt safest health-wise. There's the opportunity for known donors out there on the internet, but that wasn't something we wanted to pursue because the health and safety regulations that are followed by sperm banks was also important to us. Another thing that a lot of people think is kind of an outdated thing is that some banks will keep a donor for years and sell them kind of indefinitely, and you end up with really large sibling groups. That really is still a thing. Once you start talking to donor conceived people, that will have 40 siblings, 50 siblings. So we decided that we wanted to find a sperm bank that had kind of a strong ethics background and that actually limited the amount of families that could use a donor. And we found one that limited to 10 families. And that was how we chose which sperm bank we wanted to use.
Do you have any tips for listeners about choosing a sperm bank based on what you learned?
Absolutely. I would say do a lot of research. For me, what was the most helpful was to try to reach out to parents who had used different sperm banks and talk to them about their experiences. And also the donor sibling registry research. If you go on their page and follow the links to their research, there's some really great information there. We wanted a bank that had previously shown that if a donor or a donor's children had a disease pop up, that they would actually notify parents, whether it be a year later, 10 years later, 15 years later. We wanted a sperm bank, like I said, that had a strong family limit. We ended up going with the Sperm Bank of California, which is a small nonprofit sperm bank, because they, like I said, they have a really strong family limit. Their limit was 10, and our particular donor group was close at 8 families. They didn't have stock, but because they wanted to make sure that stock was available in the future if people wanted to pursue genetically related siblings, which I thought was really awesome.
How do you think consulting with Dr. Rogers impacted your journey?
So consulting with Dr. Rogers was really, really significant. Fear plays a strong role in the decisions that we make when we're going through our fertility journey. The doctor I was seeing locally had given us such dark odds at being able to do IVF with my own eggs that we were really leaning towards looking for a donor, even though we didn't want to start that process over. When we chose our sperm donor, we actually took 3 years to do so. And that sounds insane, but we were saving for IVF at that time anyway. So we had the time. We weren't in a rush to pick one. So we looked, and when we finally found one, I remember it was January 2016, and we actually purchased the sperm from that donor in February 2018. Once we were sure that we had picked one, we took a couple of years just to be 100% sure that we were happy with our decision. So the thought of starting that over to find an egg donor was really overwhelming, but we were also very budget conscious. We had a certain amount of money that we could devote to it, which is a really weird way to go about making a family, but it's something that comes up for all of us who are pursuing infertility treatment.
I thought I remembered reading in your notes to me that your clinic didn't want to use the sperm bank that you chose. Can you tell me more about that, or did I read that wrong?
When we went back, we had seen them briefly in 2015. We had gone in to get some more information, and they had given us a list of sperm banks that we could use. And the bank that once we researched all those banks had the best family limit, and we got the best feedback on from other people who had used the banks. So we decided that we wanted to go with the Sperm Bank of California. When we came back to them in 2018, they had narrowed down that list of sperm banks that they recommended down to three, to just like three of the major banks, California Cryo, one in Seattle, and one that was close to us locally. But actually, the one that was close to us locally that they recommend has multiple lawsuits and documented to be one of the worst ones that you can use in the area as far as ethics. And they've been taken to court, and it's been proven that they've given people pictures that don't match the donors that didn't match their profiles. So it was really crazy to me that this bank was recommended simply because it was easier for them to do paperwork with just three sperm banks. And that was why they had narrowed down their list. When we asked, the donor coordinator said they just went with the ones that were easiest to get paperwork from. That kind of created some friction when we said we wanted to go with the bank they had previously told us that we could use in 2015. But the donor coordinator said that she knew that their testing was up to standards and that they had recommended them in the past. They had used them in the past so that we would be able to use them. And honestly, if they had told us that we couldn't use them, that would have made us find a different clinic, then it was that important to us.
I want to circle back real quick for a clarification on your second opinion with Dr. Rogers. You didn't end up switching your care to her, right? You just took her feedback back to your doctor?
Yes. Honestly, if I had been able to switch care to her, that would have been amazing. But I was afraid of having to travel while doing treatment. It all seems so complicated already that adding travel up there seemed like too much. I'm down in Florida. But having her tell me that she saw no reason why we wouldn't be able to get a cycle to work, even though my AFC was so low, was the reassurance I needed to try a cycle. I don't think I would have pursued the IVF at that time if I hadn't had her tell me she's seen it work with other patients.
And how exactly did you present the information that she provided you to your doctor?
So that was awkward. I went ahead and I told her that I had gotten a second opinion from a doctor that I trusted. And I explained why I trusted that doctor and how I had learned a lot through the podcast and listening to her expert episodes with you. And the doctor looked at me like I had three heads, honestly. At the time, I had gotten an email from Dr. Rogers' nurse with kind of the recommendations. So I took that into her and I said that that was the only way that I would be comfortable pursuing a cycle, and that with my AMH level being at 0.9, that there was no way I would do a cycle with birth control. And she said that it went against her recommendations, but she would let me do it if I was so sure, but that she wouldn't allow me to do the estrogen priming, that wasn't a protocol that their clinic ever did, and that was how she was going to be able to track when to do the trigger for me. Even though it was uncomfortable, I'm so, so happy that I insisted, because she said from everything she had seen doing in a cycle with somebody with such a lower AMH level, we were expecting 4 to 5 eggs at most. And those were her exact words, 4 to 5 eggs at most. And she wasn't sure we would get that, since my enteral follicle count was usually 0, but that she was willing to gamble with us. And we ended up getting 14 eggs, 13 of which were mature. So I think the difference was absolutely not doing the birth control before.
How did your insurance coverage impact your treatment decisions?
It was huge. We had insurance coverage, but our coverage maxed out at $15,000, including medications, which you know can go incredibly quickly when doing IVF. So we were always making decisions based on what was most likely to work for the least amount of money. Technically, we could have pursued IUI, and that was something that we considered. But for us, every try at IUI wouldn't just be the cost of the IUI, but also the cost of the sperm. And with my AMH and kind of questionable eggs, that seemed kind of too risky to gamble that much money on such a low chance of getting pregnant. And then later on, once we had done the IVF and did have some blasts, it was absolutely why we decided to do double transfers, even though we didn't particularly want twins, but just because of the cost of every frozen transfer, we wanted to give it kind of the best shot possible, even though really at the end of the day, they say it only increases your chances by about 10%.
You mentioned that the Beat Infertility podcast was a big part of your journey. I'd like to hear more about how listening to the show impacted you.
Absolutely. So I found the show while I was waiting for my first appointment. It was such an incredible resource to educate myself with. I was very, very willing to do the research, but I didn't necessarily even know in what direction to go until I found the show. The journey episodes were great because it lets you see that you can get there and you can kind of make it through the journey no matter how crazy it can be. But then the bonus episodes with Dr. Rogers helped me figure out what exactly I needed to research. I learned so much about everything from what AMH was to everything, honestly, just everything. I remember just going through episode after episode, learning about the different topics that were coming up, from uterine lining to how many embryos to transfer, whether to go to for IUI or IVF, what questions to ask at your fertility clinic, which honestly, I wish I had found those even a little bit sooner than I did. It made a huge difference in making me an informed patient. And when you're an informed patient, you can advocate for yourself. And I don't think we would have been able to be successful with the coverage that we had if I hadn't known the questions to ask and I hadn't known to ask for things like skipping the birth control.
Tell me about the day when you returned to your fertility clinic a couple of years after the initial fertility assessment, and you learned that suddenly you were potentially faced with having to use donor eggs as well.
So that was overwhelming, mostly just because the thought of starting our donor journey over again was scary to us. It had been a process that had taken years. On the other side, when we were choosing our sperm donor, we are a mixed race couple and we're both minorities, which is not the easiest to find when you're looking at donors. So that cuts down the donor options significantly already. On the other side, it's so much easier to find a sperm donor if you're going the frozen route, but eggs are a whole different ballgame. You have to figure out whether you're doing fresh or frozen. There's so many more considerations. The egg donors are amazing for what they go through to donate because cycles are so difficult. But the thought of having to sync cycles and just add that whole other layer to our fertility journey was overwhelming.
Tell me about the lowest point during your journey and how you regained the strength to carry on.
So after our second transfer, I remember asking the nurse when she called and told us that it was a negative, if there was like even a little bit of a hint of a hope there, because at my clinic, they do the HCG test 8 days after transfer, which is considered kind of early. And she said that there was the note that there was no hope at all. And then so we stopped the medications, and then a couple of days later, the app loaded, and it showed me that my HCG level had been at 3. So technically, it wasn't a 0. And even though it's a terrible number, I would have liked to have known that and maybe continue medication a couple more days. So that was really, really rough emotionally, even though it would have been an absolute gamble anyway. But that really destroyed a lot of what trust I had left with that clinic. And it was a big part of the reason of why I decided to go ahead and pursue a different opinion elsewhere locally. It took some time to get over the fact that maybe there had been a possibility, or even if it wasn't truly a possibility, I felt like the clinic hadn't been honest with me. That was hard after spending so much time, money, emotional energy pursuing something, to feel like you weren't getting the full story from your clinical team.
How about a positive or even funny moment from your journey?
The funniest moment in our journey was the day that we were supposed to go to our IVF class that was required for the clinic to be able to start our IVF treatment. They hold it once a month. That morning, my best friend, who was like my sister, called me and told me she had gone into labor, and I was going to be one of the people in the room with her to support her during that. So that morning, once I got the call, I rushed to the hospital and I held her hand through labor and I welcomed my new nephew into the world. I loved on him and then had to be like, oh, I gotta go now. I'm so happy the baby's here, but I have to go take a class so I can learn how to have my own baby. The irony of that, running out of literally labor and delivery to go to an IVF class, was pretty special.
Let's circle back to work again. How did you balance work and fertility treatments?
Luckily, my job had kind of flexible hours a little bit, so I could schedule my appointments in the morning and go in at noon. I did that a lot. The other thing that truly helped was I was very upfront with my coworkers. I had been at that job for years at that point. I just honestly let them know what I was going through, and it meant a lot of support from my team. I had worked with some of those managers for years. Since my husband worked for the same company, they had all known this when we were dating and when we were engaged, and kind of had been waiting for us to start a family. It was years later and they were all like, we'll do whatever you need. They were really supportive. They were supportive through the entire journey, as far as giving us time after transfers to stay home if we needed, and also just everyday appointments. If the manager couldn't accommodate it, another coworker would switch shifts with me so that I could go to my appointments and have it not be stressful. It was really a blessing to be open about it because they were so, so accommodating.
Did insurance end up covering everything? And if not, how were you able to afford the rest?
So the reason we were able to afford it was because we had known it was coming and started putting money aside and had some savings especially for that. But honestly, without the insurance, we wouldn't have been able to cover everything. So it wouldn't have happened at the time that it did. The insurance was incredibly significant for us and it didn't cover everything, but it covered a big chunk. And more than that, I was told so many times that the insurance wasn't going to cover medication, or the insurance wasn't going to cover the embryo preservation, or the insurance has never paid for this, or insurance has never paid for that. I learned to never take that first no or the second no. I spent so much time on the phone with my insurance company. I got them to send me plan documents when my plan said that they would cover medications and then they were denying the medications. I took it to my HR department. HR sent me to a different department through corporate, and I ended up talking to the person who was the liaison for the company with the insurance, showed her literally that our plan said it was covered and they were denying my coverage. And within 2 days of talking to her, she talked to the insurance company on my behalf. All of my medication after that were covered. So it made a huge, huge difference to truly pursue every avenue I had to get the coverage that we needed. Even when I wasn't sure if something would be covered, I would always keep asking. And the reason that I did that was because actually when I first went to the RE at that other job that I had, I was told that that insurance had zero coverage and I paid for that first appointment out of pocket. And then in December, at the end of the year, I got a check from the RE's office for the full amount that I had paid them. And when I called them to ask why, they said, oh, once we actually talked to your insurance, it turned out that insurance company was based out of Massachusetts and they covered everything and they would have even covered a full IVF cycle. And I didn't know that because I took what the doctor's office told me at face value instead of pursuing it and talking to the insurance company myself.
How did infertility change your relationship with your husband?
I would say infertility changed the relationship with my husband. Even though we knew that this was something we need to pursue, you can't even imagine the kind of questions that come up or the emotions that come up when you're actually going through it. And it definitely made us a stronger team. It deepened my trust in him because he was always there. He shared the level of commitment. When I was afraid to give myself a shot, he was there 100% of the time. It was funny because eventually I learned to prefer to give myself the shots. But he was so involved at that point that I just let him do it because it made him feel like he had a little bit of control in something. And I can definitely understand how when you're going through all the ups and downs of not knowing what's around the corner with a cycle, how helpful that is. It became a huge bonding thing for us. It deepened our relationship in a way that I didn't even know that it could.
What about friends and family? Did infertility change any of those relationships?
Yeah, and it's kind of crazy because for some, it strengthened them. In others, it really drove them away. I wouldn't have been able to guess which was which before we went through it. But one of my best friends was so amazing at checking in with me and wanting to know about every step of the process. She would ask after every appointment. She would check in all the time. It made us so much closer that she was so understanding and that she had so much empathy while I was going through my journey. We were close at work, but we weren't close outside of work. And now she's one of my best friends in the world and truly an aunt to my daughter. And then there were others who I was closer to that didn't understand what I was going through or said stuff that was just so insensitive that I had to back away from their relationships. We're just no longer so close.
How has infertility changed you?
It made me braver. I don't think I knew how to advocate for myself with doctors and with other people who I regarded as having maybe, I don't know if saying that level of authority and level of knowledge. Before, I would have been a lot more likely to say yes and go along with what they said. I learned that the best thing that I could do for myself was to get as informed as possible, whether it was through a podcast, through researching medical papers myself, and to form my own opinion so that I could better understand what I was being told and whether I agreed with it or not. Down the road, when I got my last second opinion or consult from a local RE, I was able to tell him not just exactly what was going on, but what my opinion was about the treatment that I needed. And I told him, you are the doctor and I'll absolutely listen to everything that you have to say, but I'm going to tell you the truth. If you want a patient who just agrees and doesn't have some questions for you to answer, then we're not going to be able to get along as far as a doctor-patient relationship is. I feel that I have to take an active role in my care now, and I have to learn enough to ask the questions and not just accept a treatment plan from anyone.
Knowing what you know now, what is one piece of advice that you give to your past self?
Take the time to do it right. When you have been waiting for years and you just want to be at the other side and be done dealing with the infertility, it's really easy to rush it. It's easy to take the first doctor that's going to see you. Easy to take just whatever the quick answer is. I wish we had taken more time and truly figured out what the best fit in a clinic was for us, what we were looking for. The same time and care that we took with the decision about what donor we were going to use, I wish we had applied that to the rest of our journey.
To wrap up the episode, what words of hope would you offer to someone who's just beginning their infertility journey right now?
So that's a big one. I would say you can absolutely get there. You just have to keep going. Have faith. You can absolutely get where you want to go. You just have to keep going. Sometimes the choices that we make don't turn out exactly like what we expect them to, but that doesn't mean that they're not great. It might take a little bit longer. You might have to endure a little bit more, but as long as you keep looking for a way to make what you want happen, you'll get there.
Dani, thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing your story with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hey, Infertility Warrior, it's Heather. This episode of Beat Infertility is brought to you by me. Regular listeners of the show know that I struggled during my infertility journey with everything from finding the right clinic to advocating for a protocol customized to my body to allowing infertility to consume my entire existence and everything in between. In other words, I've been where you are. Now that I'm on the other side and have interviewed hundreds of other warriors and fertility experts, I've discovered the fastest way to realize your dream of becoming a parent is to get educated, regain hope, build resiliency, learn self-advocacy skills, and partner with someone who's been there. Whether you're an infertility newbie or a seasoned veteran, it would be my honor and privilege to provide, as one client put it, unwavering support with fully engulfing and genuine empathy. If you'd like to learn more or schedule a free 30-minute call to discuss how I can support you during your infertility journey, go to beatinfertility.co/hope. Now, back to the show.
Thank you for listening to Beat Infertility. Join our free private support community at beatinfertility.co/app. If you find yourself needing additional support, visit our paid programs at beatinfertility.co/hopeyou. If you'd like your story to be considered for a future episode, please fill out the form at beatinfertility.co/contact. Until next time.